From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment.
The Treatment. My guest is actor, writer, director, and as a director, his work in TV alone over the last couple of decades has been kind of an astonishing leap from directing Heat Vision and Jack to Escape at Dannemora to his newest directing endeavor, which is Severance, which is on Apple Plus TV. Ben Stiller is my guest. Ben, I can't thank you enough for doing this.
Thanks, Elvis. It's nice to be with you.
I just find myself thinking about so often, primarily as a director, you've worked on pieces that have been about reality or people's idea of what reality is, kind of knits together Tropic Thunder and Zoolander, even to some extent, and you know, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. And I just wonder where that interest in that kind of thing comes from for you.
I mean, reality is kind of interesting to me because it's what everything is about, isn't it? It's kind of like what our lives are about. I definitely think, you know, in Walter Mitty and Severance, there are certain themes that come through in terms of just being kind of disconnected, you know. And as we go through life, I think we all have to sort of cope with all the things that life throws at us. And I know in my own experience, there are coping mechanisms and ways of getting through challenging times that involve sort of, you know, having to sort of put up some sort of a shield or, you know, sort of cutting off from maybe being as sensitive or being in touch with emotions or memories and things like that, that, you know, you're not even aware of as you're going through life. I mean, this is just my own experience. So I think that Severance, you know, definitely deals with that in a very sort of specific way, in that, there, you know, this character's actually gotten a procedure to cut himself off from his memories. But yeah, I think, you know, that's, What is reality? I don't know. It's what you and I are here talking. We are, you know, I'm looking out at the window. I'm seeing a skyline of New York. You're seeing what you're seeing. And it's happening now, and it's real. But, you know, your perception and my perception of it are, you know, different. I was actually just listening on the radio this morning to somebody talking about the perception of color and how do we as human beings really understand what that is, and how do we all share that same perception, but how would you even describe it? You know, those questions can just take you down a rabbit hole and make your brain explode. So I guess I am interested in that stuff on some level.
Well, my brain's exploding already. We're barely 2 minutes into this, but I mean, you think about all these things, even in Walter Mitty, he's somewhat disconnected. We could definitely say all the characters in Tropic Thunder live in their own realities. And that idea of people having this thing that's specific to them, a reality that's specific, this sort of netherworld between the real world and what reality is and how they define it. I mean, I just think that's a really interesting thing. And it also gives these pieces shapes where they can move from comedy to drama pretty seamlessly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you bring up actors, you know, and acting or making movies or doing theater, it is creating a reality that is an emotional reality, but it's not our actual reality. And that's a weird thing. And I think for actors who get caught up in that, that's a lot of what, obviously, the jokes and the humor Tropic Thunder is, are about actors who take themselves so seriously or get so caught up in that. But it is a fact that it is a strange thing to live as an actor, is that you're trying to recreate emotions or situations that, you know, that you're pulling from your real life and real things that have happened. But then if it's good, it's feeling real also. So that can, I think, mess with an actor's sense of just sort of like what is their life about? You know, they're sort of, you know, that's what their job is to do that. And we love to watch actors doing that because it helps us get in touch with our own feelings that are repressed. You know, I can go to a movie and cry, and, you know, what I'm crying about is probably not what's going on the screen. It's just touching something inside of me, a situation that I connect with. And so that's a repressed feeling that I have as an audience member. And it's necessary. It's cathartic. It's helpful. So actors are doing that all the time in their job too.
I guess I've always wanted to ask you this. If you have kind of a philosophical approach to things that you want to do as a director, because even going back to the cable guy, these guys living in two separate realities and this, the effect that one has on the other.
Well, I guess, yeah, in Cable Guy, I think, you know, one character, Jim Carrey's character, is, you know, sort of like obsessed with media too, and, you know, and sort of like lives his life through that, but doesn't really have any real life friendship or connection. His perception, a lot of his perception of the world is through what he watches. I can identify with that a lot, having grown up watching a lot of television. And I think we're all so affected by that. So yeah, I'm interested in that, that we're all so affected by what we see, what we take in, how that sort of contributes to who we are. It's like, we're not living in a vacuum. We're living in we have so much sensory input that's happening all the time. And a lot of it is what we choose to watch and take in. So that does affect us. And I think that's the idea of like where you're coming from, where I'm coming from. You know, that's a basic issue that affects everything in our lives, whether it's talking about entertainment and, you know, emotions and all that, to like political views and all that, you know. So it is a kind of a basic idea of what it is to be living right now, and what to be living with people. This is getting very, very strange. But I think, you know, what you're hitting on is the idea that we all kind of experience things from our own point of view. And that point of view is affected by a lot of different things.
We're getting pretty heady with my guest, Ben Stiller, whose newest project is, I'm not sure how one would describe Severance, except to say that it's on Apple TV Plus, and he's directed 6 of the 9 episodes. So let's do that. How would you describe Severance to people?
I mean, I guess it's a sort of a reality that's like an alternate reality. It's not a science fiction show. I think it's, you know, based in technology that could exist and that probably will exist, where you know, you can get a chip put in your head and have certain parts of your memory cut off. So it's a, you know, it's a show that's about a guy works at a company where he goes to work and he forgets who he is on the outside, and then when he leaves work, he forgets everything that happened at work, and he's done this procedure voluntarily. And it's, so I guess it's kind of a slightly surreal world, but it's also very much, I think, grounded in a reality that we live in now. I mean, the other part of it is it's a comedy too, in that I think that Dan Erickson, who created it and wrote it, you know, came up with this idea having watched shows like The Office or movies like Office Space and the workplace comedy. And that's a genre that I think has evolved over the last 20 or 30 years in American television and movies. And this is sort of taking that genre and spinning it a little bit in a surreal way.
The workplace comedy has really probably been like sort of the benchmark of American TV, going back to the old Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Yeah, it's probably, you're right. It's older than that. It probably goes, yeah, it goes back maybe to the Dick Van Dyke Show, right? Before that too, right?
Absolutely. Where people seem to, the home lives don't really seem to matter in any way. It's the office or the work life that really is the front of all the comedy. But I think I'm always fascinated by, as a director, the way you use headspace. And I'm just thinking about in Dannemora and in this, they're really claustrophobic frames that you use around the characters. I mean, there's a lot of room on either side of them, but over their head, there's not much room at all. That idea of almost the world seemed coming down or just being really oppressive, the frame, it's a really interesting thing to do to sort of get that ambience across, that emotional state.
You know, both of those are shot in the widescreen aspect ratio, you know, which is a little more claustrophobic on the top and the bottom because it's wider on the sides, but yet it's also the sort of, you know, that anamorphic frame is big movies use it too. But I think when you shoot something in that aspect ratio that is not epic, it ends up, you know, making you kind of, it's harder to fit people sometimes into the frames for close-ups because the, you know, the 1:8:5 ratio is a little bit more top and bottom. So it's easier to do. So I like that aspect ratio though, because it does create stranger frames and it does make you have to, like, if you go in for a close-up, you're going to cut off parts of the top or the bottom of someone's head. And I think that's interesting, you know. I don't think about it consciously. I just think when you make a choice to shoot something in that frame size, it sort of then dictates that, okay, this is not really exactly how we're seeing life all the time. And so you can get a little more specific with how you, you know, where you put somebody in the frame and what you focus on as a viewer.
Somebody told me that there would be a workplace comedy that was shot like the Parallax for you. I would say, okay.
Might not be so funny. The thing is, this script actually, I mean, Dan really had a very clear sense of in the pilot when I read it of this world, but it was very funny to me when I read the pilot. And I think maybe I might have sucked some of the humor out of it in the way that the direction we went. But I think that was also what was interesting to me was that, you know, and I always love anything that is not really a specific genre, you know. Parallax is probably not a good example of that, but you know, movies that in the 70s and 80s even that might have been able to sort of cross genres a little more, or within a comedy there might have been a lot more serious stuff going on or less of a redemptive ending, or you know, everything getting tied up in a bow. And you know, just the idea that you could put something that's a genre that you might think of as like almost like a sitcom, but then in this other world and in this, through, you know, through this other lens, kind of literally and figuratively, that to me was really interesting. But I think the humor is still an important part of that.
I was thinking about in the first episode, and maybe the first 10 minutes or so, how funny it is that we're constantly in these white hallways. Yeah. It's really funny because it's just, wait, what? How much long is this going to go on? And this is actually 30 seconds of Adam Scott walking down a hallway, not saying anything. This tension, which is like, again, I think for you, that line that sort of intersects comedy and drama is, when is something going to happen and what's going to happen is something that you're definitely doing with this, isn't it?
Yeah. And you know, that shot in particular was sort of, you know, I guess almost an experiment really when we were editing, because I knew that scene had to show him going to his office for the first time. And the point of it was to show that the place was, you know, sort of a labyrinth and you couldn't really tell where it was. And you know, and there was a long way to go. And I wanted it to feel confusing. But then we did one take where we just said, let's just shoot him walking the entire set and see how that goes. And it was a choice to do that because I thought, oh, yeah, this kind of maybe can sort of signal that this reality is a little bit off, or the rhythm of this show might be a little bit unpredictable. There's a moment in that shot where Adam, because he's so funny and good as an actor, there's like about halfway through the shot, he checks his watch, which is always to me like a moment where I feel like as an audience member, you're sort of checking your watch going like, how long is this shot going to go on? And Adam just sort of did that kind of instinctively. But yeah, that was, you know, that's one of those things that just sort of was an experiment and then a choice. And when we were editing, to say, yeah, let's go with this and see how this feels in terms of, you know, how the audience will feel a little bit maybe off put, but maybe it's also funny the longer it goes on or weirder. And, you know, it's always that fine line. You don't want to be indulgent. So you have to kind of, you're trying to make those calls as you go along for yourself.
We'll take a break. It's The Treatment. My guest who sees the comedy in Alan J. Pakula is Ben Stiller, whose newest project is Severance for Apple TV Plus. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's The Treatment. My guest, who probably saw The Sterile Cuckoo one time too many, is Ben Stiller. His newest project for Apple TV Plus is Severance. And one of the things we were talking about before the break, and we've actually had conversations about this before, sort of playing with reality versus illusion, or more specifically, what somebody else's reality is, clearly comes from being in a house, growing up in a household where you had parents who were creating all the time. And I always thought of your parents as being actors first and comedians second. And so that constant sort of playing with the line, I mean, your mom could do sketch comedy and then do something as brilliant as Kate McShane, which is a show that had a huge influence on me, just seeing a woman lawyer in a TV show in the 70s. I don't know if that ever happened before, but just the way that kind of constant movement between all these worlds, it feels to me has really kind of shaped your outlook in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine how my life would have been if my parents hadn't been actors and I hadn't had that upbringing, because it really was, you know, what my life was about and my sister's life was about, was being around my parents and their work. And I do think that was the first woman lawyer starring in the show, Kate McShane. It only lasted, I think, like a season or less. But, you know, she was a great actress and my dad was a really good actor, too. And they both started out doing that first. And I think my dad always had the comedy dream of doing stand-up. My mom never really had that, but then my dad sort of pulled her into it. And of course, she was really amazing at it. You know, around the house, it was a lot of work being done that was, you know, that was their writing and their creating. And then, you know, my father, I'm working on a documentary actually about my folks now. You know, there's a lot of recordings my dad made, audio recordings of their rehearsals in the house. And he was recording stuff all the time. And I hear him talking to my mom and sort of like pulling out of her the stuff that he thought was, you know, really funny from their lives that they could turn into material. So they were pulling on their own experience a lot. And especially my dad sort of, you know, was really curious about how to take, I think it was actually, you know, to be able to like see something in your own life and go, oh, this is funny. And, you know, it's what people like Gary Shandling or Larry David have done, and really taking their own experience and saying, okay, this, by being this honest, you know, people can relate because it's a real thing. And I think my dad was really interested in doing that. And so, yeah, we were around that all the time. And it seemed actually fun and exciting from my point of view as a kid.
Basically, watching your parents step out of one reality on the set into another reality when they came to talk to you and your sister. I mean, just that reality is this really kind of permeable membrane.
You know, that to watch them at home on television being on a game show or doing a talk show, and then they would come home and they would be our parents. And yeah, it was a different thing. Because people always used to ask, oh, your parents funny at home? And they weren't really funny at home. They were just our parents, but they were also, it wasn't because they weren't funny people, I think. And we laughed and, you know, we had very loving household and, you know, they were loving parents, but they were at home. They were working a lot to work on those sketches and that material that then they would perform and we would watch on TV or, you know, see them do. And so that there was a real difference between that for sure.
Some of these things you've done as a director, although even for me as an actor, it goes back to you in Permanent Midnight, is about the level of commitment that somebody makes to something, and either they jump all the way in or they kind of don't. And the moment we meet Adam's character in Severance, we can sort of see that line seems to be kind of wavering for him about if this thing he's done, was it convenient or right? That level of people just sort of like seizing a moment or whatever seems to be key to the way you think as a storyteller too.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you do things in life and they have repercussions too. You know, whenever something happens that you do, like, you know, you have an accident or something and you break a bone, and then it's like, oh gosh, if I just hadn't done that. But then you have to live with the reality of that. And I think in a way, Adam's character is dealing with that, where he's, you know, made this decision that's irreversible to have this chip put in his head at a time when he's grieving his wife. You know, in a way, it's helped him get through, but also, as his sister points out, you know, it's also not really grieving to just cut off from that. I think acting-wise, you have to commit fully. And it's one of the things I think that, for me, actors that I really admire, just there's no question when you see them in a role that they're just fully in that. And when someone's not, it's not something maybe that's even conscious, but you just don't feel it as much. And, you know, that's what, for me, acting has always been about. And I think acting is really challenging in that way. You know, having not acted for a few years and working as a director and watching actors work, I've had more of an appreciation of that actually the last few years.
It's the treatment. We're talking about commitment with our old friend Ben Stiller, whose new project for Apple TV Plus is Severance. I guess I was thinking about this too, also because there are actors in this piece who we sort of like, as soon as we see them, we kind of smile because we know the level of intensity we're going to see from them, like John Turturro, right. or certainly Christopher Walken. But it's also interesting too, because I love the way you've used Patricia Arquette, and she couldn't be two more different people, even in this show, in her two different yeah. lives, let alone then escape Dana Moore. But your relationship to acting is really interesting too, because you tend to cast with an eye for the way people are going to watch people that they know versus people that they don't. So surrounding Adam with a cast of actors who may be new to a lot of us, and then sticking him in that workplace where there's people that we know, creates all kinds of interesting associations.
Yeah, that's the fun thing, I think, about casting is thinking about that and thinking about what's the mix, you know, what's the combination going to be and what do audiences bring as baggage, you know, with an actor. And, you know, it's something, you know, being an actor, it's something you can't really control and can be frustrating too, if, you know, as an actor when you, you know, want to get jobs too, because, like, you know, whoever's hiring me, they're gonna, you know it's Ben Stiller, and an audience brings whatever preconceptions they have, you know, and that can be a, you know, a good thing, and also could be a negative thing. But when you're directing, I think you have to take all of that in, so, you know, as part of the combination or the formula of what you're doing, because I felt very much that Adam had this workplace comedy sort of demeanor and persona that a lot of people associate him with. And I thought that was a really good thing for this show. And the idea that he could be with a couple of other actors that we might not quite know, but felt very much in that world and right for the roles. And then bringing in someone like Turturro, who I think you just, there's an intensity there that he has. And, you know, whatever audiences bring, knowing it's Turturro, I think there's like a sense that you just know Turturro is always going to be committed to whatever it is he's, you know, whatever part he's playing. And the belief that he has in this world and actually in the sort of ideology of the corporate structure there for his character, it's just so deep. And that energy combined with Adam's sort of kind of more glib, lighter energy in that office workplace environment, already you start to feel like, okay, there could be interesting tension here happening. And then you bring in someone like Tramell Tillman, who plays Milchick, who's sort of, you know, overseeing them. And, you know, he's a guy you maybe don't know that much about. And so there's a more of a mystery behind his eyes in terms of, you know, where is he coming from, which is, I think, good for an audience not to know. So yeah, that all that stuff is really fun in putting it together and thinking about how also actors can subvert expectations. And Patricia, I think, is just one of those actors who can go to a lot of different places. She has such depth and intensity and also beauty and just a grace about her that then when she, if she chooses to sort of like dial into this other aspect, sort of the darker aspect of who she is, and then, you know, add in the humor she has too, always, I feel there's so many different things she can do. So yeah, that, it's been a fun process putting that all together.
There's something that's slightly prison-like about Lumen and the way it sounds, and even the way doors close, and then there's a slightly warmer sound as he gets up, but still he's alienated from, again, and by that last episode, when those worlds are all crashing into each other in audio terms, it's a really a cool thing to sort of bring to fruition, to sort of show how this stuff is all collapsing on itself. And that was that something you saw as you were reading that first script and thought, oh, I can make this work, because there are all these things you can do both with the visuals and audio for this.
Yeah, I mean, when I first read the pilot, I just got very excited because it was so evocative. And there was something about even just the dialogue itself, that first scene where Helly's on the table and Mark's giving her the questionnaire to see, you know, if this process, we don't know what's going on. It was just so strange. And the questions he's asking her about, you know, what she remembers the mother, her, the color of her mother's eyes. And I was just so intrigued by it. And then as I saw the structure of the pilot allows you to understand what's happening in that first scene from the other point of view later in the show, I thought that was so interesting, and realizing, oh, this strange, weird place is actually just a workplace for some of the people who work here. That talking about points of view, and I know this is more of a technical question, but just the points of view in the show where you can go, oh, I can look at it from this point of view, where it feels like this weird, surreal science fiction story. And then from this point of view, where it feels like just a couple of guys who are doing their work in this place, having to interview a new person coming into the office. That was really fascinating to me. And then, you know, all those other things in terms of the actual sounds and the images and the visuals, all of that came out of what was on the page there being so evocative, I guess. And then it like opens up so many different doors and so many different questions. And there's just so much you can fill it with when you have a really great idea and somebody who's written something with such a specific tone.
What touching things does to people in the show is really interesting, because there's not a lot of actual contact physically in that first episode. Again, just of these worlds collapsing seems to revolve around making physical contact by the very end, at least to me.
Yeah. And I mean, that was fun in the last episode where it kind of gets to where, you know, there's an experience that they're having with the outside world. And in terms of transitions going between the different stories and the different realities, you know, that was fun to play with sound too, in terms of glitching and the idea of, you know, kind of reintegration, you know, because a lot of this story is about, I think, ultimately over the course of the whole series is about Mark's character, his innie and his outie, both somehow trying to get closer to each other to become a whole person. I think that's sort of like an overarching idea of the show. And so to figure out ways to go between those two realities with sound and visuals, that's a lot of fun to do that. And then, but in terms of like just the smallest things, people touching each other inside in a place where you're really not allowed physical contact, or to see the sky, or to be outside, or just for the first time, things like that, when there's so little that these characters are allowed to experience, then, you know, one thing can be such a huge change for them. And I think the actors really were able to dig into that and bring that to life.
And so many of these things you've done, that the idea of corporate presence sort of hovering over somebody's, the protagonist's shoulder, kind of runs through all these things too. And the idea of where corporations sit in terms of creating a reality that people step into.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, that it's just the world that we live in too. I mean, the meta idea is also that we're doing the show on Apple, you know, Plus TV too. You know, like these are all like, but you know, there isn't really any show that's not being done on a platform that is run by a big corporation, really. So that's the irony too, is that we're all like being the given the opportunity to be creative, but we are working within these bigger superstructures. And, you know, I think Dan really drew that well in this show, where he created almost a, you know, it's almost a religious ideology at this company that's based in the founder. And that idea of, you know, corporate culture really taken to a place where it's, for these people who work on the lower level, it's almost religion to them, because that's all they know. It's all they've been taught. I'll take everything back to a Star Trek episode, but there's, you know, this great Star Trek episode where the world is hollow and I've touched the sky, where these people are living in this planet, but it's really actually a hollow planet. I guess it's like a little bit like Truman Show too, where, you know, they realize, oh, they're actually on the inside of something. That's what, you know, that's the life that these people are living. And they want to, they've heard of something on the outside, but they don't know what it is. And so, you know, that's a very potent idea.
Well, I guess we would expect a Star Trek reference from the man whose company is called Red Hour. We're out of time. But I guess who has come up with something that can only be called an intersection between The Office and The Matrix, the show is Severance. It's directed by Ben Stiller. Ben, thank you so much for doing this. Always great talking to you.
Great talking to you, Alex. Thanks, man.
It's The Treatment, and that was Ben Stiller, whose current project is Severance on Apple TV+. Still to come, Chloe Sevigny, flushing a career renaissance and starring in The Girl from Plainville on Hulu. If you can't stay with us, please enjoy this interview and past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com/thetreatment or wherever you get your podcasts. This is Motor Come. Stay with us.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Earn your graduate degree in a flexible online format from University of Southern California and learn from faculty at the top of their fields in areas such as business, health, law, engineering, psychology, communications, and more. Explore your options today at online.usc.edu.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest, I think, was being somebody whose early films by major filmmakers she's been a big part of, from the film debuts as directors of Larry Clark and Kimberly Pierce and Steve Buscemi, one of my favorite films, Trees Lounge. She's also worked in early films with Mary Harron, Luca Guadagnino for a miniseries, and her latest venture we can see her in is The Girl from Plainville on Hulu. It's, of course, I'm talking to Chloe Sevigny. Chloe, thank you so much for doing this. And it really is kind of fascinating how many early films you've been in by major filmmakers. I mean, I've known Steve for a long time, and he was really excited about having you for Trees Lounge. And that's before, Boys Don't Cry.
Yeah, I had only been in the film Kids. And Kerry Woods, who was the producer of Kids, had been an agent at William Morris. They really kind of helped us find a footing within the industry. Steve Buscemi's film, Trees Lounge, he kind of went out on a limb casting me after I'd only been in Kids. Just recently, I'd invited him to my wedding. Unfortunately, he was unavailable. But yeah, it was really like an important first step for me after Kids to work in a movie alongside all these great like New York character actors that I like hero worshipped, you know, Carol Kane and Seymour Cassell and Debbie Mazar and Mike Imperioli and Kevin Corrigan and like people who were my peers and elders.
But I mean, that Steve, as an actor, to have somebody like that trust in you that early in your career must have been a big vote of confidence for you, wasn't it?
Kind of. I remember later him telling a story of like us rehearsing and him wanting me to improvise and me totally freezing and being like, I don't really know how to do that. And he's like, is this girl going to work out? And he like almost fired me. And I was like, no, don't worry. I'm shy and I'm comfortable and I don't really have my own voice yet. But once we get on set, I can do this. I can play this character. I know this girl. I can do this for you. Just trust me.
It feels like to me at a certain point, probably for you in the early part of your career, you were working and we could almost see the dawning of the character in you. Like I can sort of recognize it in Boys Don't Cry. And I just wonder, you felt like in those early films, you were kind of hitting a sweet spot and you knew who the character was at that point.
Some of them, I think I just was like going through a lot of things that some of the characters were going through themselves, like Last Days of Disco. You know, I moved into the city. I was romanticizing an era that had come right before me and living with often difficult roommates. And so like, they're just like different characters each, you know, like Lana and Boys Don't Cry, falling in love with someone that was troubled and was searching for their own, you know, identity and voice. And there were things that I related to in each of my characters and still do.
I just think it's interesting that you were in so many first films, even Party Monster being like a dramatic debut for Fenton and Randy. I wonder what it is you think that makes you so prized by directors making their debuts.
I don't know. Maybe I was just available.
Oh, come on now.
I don't know. I mean, hopefully they were like, you know, they believed in me as a talent. It was like, at least we know, you know, she'll turn out a good performance. I mean, I don't know. I don't want to be presumptuous, but I mean, one would hope that they would trust in my ability to convey something, some truth in the character that they wanted to portray, they wanted me to portray.
I guess think that's got to be kind of interesting because too, you're finding your way as they're finding their ways as well. So it must have been a really interesting and in a lot of ways satisfying relationship.
Very satisfying, yeah, more collaborative than some of the older, more established directors I worked with later years. Yeah, I mean, every director has their own process and, you know, every film and TV experience is profoundly different. And that's what makes it so challenging and exciting. And that's why I love actually working in TV when you have like these great creators or showrunners that have a true vision, and then you have different directors coming in and out. So you have to kind of navigate between those two. And you know, there's someone overseeing everything that has a real vision, but you have these directors coming in and you have to learn to work with their input. But also you, where you're like, well, I've been around longer than you have. I know more about this character than you do. So like having to like figure out how to utilize what they're bringing.
On The Girl from Plainville, you got to connect with somebody who I wonder if you'd ever met before, Lisa Chulodenko, who did the first episode.
I know. I think I was actually either offered or very close to getting a part in High Art. I can't remember exactly. It was one or the other. And I remember always thinking like, oh God, the art world is so hard to capture correctly. You know, I kind of was like surfing on the periphery. I still am. I have a lot of friends in the art world. And when I was younger, making a film with Larry Clark kids and then getting into the New York art scene. And I was like, this is just such a difficult world to capture. Nobody's done it well. I was really scared of that movie that she was going to make. And then, of course, we met on Girl from Plainville and got along famously. And I hope she calls me up when she makes her next feature.
My guest, who should be hired again by Lisa Chelodenko, is Chloe Sevigny. Her newest project on Hulu is The Girl from Plainville. And I guess I was finding myself thinking, too, as long as we're talking about that, in that first episode, it, to me, is interesting watching the thinking about the first and last episodes, but especially in the first episode where we get this real sort of sense of dread when she's mm-hmm. talking and just letting the cops know that she knows her son is at all the time. She's always in touch with him. And I wonder how you felt about playing, first of all, somebody that who's real, but also to be introduced to her for us at that stage in her life.
It was a heavy 5 months. I mean, it's always sensitive to tell someone's real story, true crime especially, you know, when something so devastating has happened to someone in someone's lives and trying to capture even some small fraction of the feelings that they must be going through and, you know, how they're trying to survive this trauma and what's happened to them. And there's just a lot of care and consideration and respect that I know everybody on the team from The Girl from Plainville put into this. And I know that Lynn had given the show her blessing and it was very important to her that people hear her son's story. And that made it somewhat easier for me to navigate, you know, telling the story.
It's so interesting too, because it's like a certain point, I can almost have seen you playing Michelle, somebody who's trying to figure herself out in that same way. And I just watching you play that early scene with her in that first episode, I thought, wow, my goodness, you're trying to figure out how much you want to let her in. But also it's a very vulnerable moment for you. I just thought that was, it's interesting watching you show that much control as an actor.
Yes, thanks to Lisa, I guess. And thanks to the showrunners letting us do that kind of acting, that kind of show, this, you know, really what I call quiet acting, very internal, and letting us have a lot of breath and space to let interactions land between the characters and just having that room felt very right for the story we wanted to tell. There's so much to explore there, but we didn't want it to seem salacious, obviously, and even though it could so easily go in that direction. So I think, yeah, Lisa's tone that she set with the great Fred Elms as a cinematographer, who I'd worked with on numerous occasions with Jim Jarmusch, I just felt like they were really handling it in the right way with the right care and consideration.
It's so interesting. I guess I was thinking about this and We Are Who We Are. And just they're both cases where you really get to flex a lot of really sort of subtle muscle as an actor. And it was, for me, having watched you for so long, it's really gratifying to just see the concentration you were able to bring to bear in both these parts.
I'm trying to get back to being a better actress.
What do you mean you get back to being a better
I don't know. I felt like I kind of went off the rails for a minute, or some of the work. Maybe I don't know. I think there were some cases where some showrunners or directors were really asking me to play the stakes a lot. And I felt like I wasn't sure like how to push my performance, like what was the breaking point. Like, so I was going to kind of uncomfortable places, which is fun and rewarding in its own way. But I felt like I was kind of flying off the handle a bit or becoming shrill or something. There was something in my performances that wasn't as grounded. But perhaps it's just me being hard on myself, which is historically accurate as well. But yeah, Luca Guadagnino, I mean, I can't, I don't have enough great things to say about that man. Talk about giving actors space. And also like there's moments in We Are Who We Are where he really wanted me to be silly, which I am quite like silly and goofy and in real life, as all my friends can attest. And he saw that in me. So there are these moments where you see that character who's so buttoned up and she's, you know, holding the family together. She's a military person, obviously. And so she has these moments where she like sings Lady Gaga and like gets crazy and spins around and like is like just kind of a, for lack of a better word, a dork. And like, and so having those moments with him at the helm, like knowing that I would look dorky, but not too dorky, was really fun. to be able to just kind of let it rip for him.
This has got to be a first by guest. It's the treatment, by the way. I guess it's Chloe Sevigny, who's actually using the word dork to describe herself. We're talking about her multiplicity of projects, most recently, of course, being the girl from Plainville. But we were also talking about We Are Who We Are, and you said grounded. And that's something that both these characters have in common. We feel their feet on the ground, so they are being kind of loose and playful. Like I was thinking of the last episode of The Girl from Plainville, when we sort of see her with her son. Again, it's got to be a hard moment to play, given what you played at the outset of the show, but there's lightness there. She's sort of making fun of him, making fun of herself. I mean, it's a great moment. She's telling him he should be wearing a Speedo from this guy that nobody should be forced to look at. These characters can go from that kind of sort of guardedness to being playful. For me, it was really this sign that you, maybe this just the material you had a chance to step up to in a way that you hadn't in a long time.
It's also, I mean, the nature of life and human experience is not all doom and gloom. I mean, that's what was so shocking for her, that, you know, they had this amazing day on the beach where they were laughing and eating guacamole and doing silly things. And there was no indication that he was suffering to the extent that he was. I mean, that was one of the harder scenes to do. I mean, talk about technically, because you're thinking that this was really like the last moment she's having with him. And it's, you know, one of the lightest moments in the show. I mean, luckily I had such a great scene partner in Colton, who played Coco Roy, and we really connected on a deeply personal level. And it was really beautiful just to look in this young man's eyes and get to play off of him.
And you're talking about Colton Ryan, who plays your son. And I guess the real heartbreak is the last moment he's leaving the house, and you can sort of feel the guest weekend, obviously, he wants to sort of connect with her in some way, and she just kind of goes, okay, bye, and they're not even in the same room. And it's just, again, I was wondering what it's like to play that, given what you had, the obviously the knowledge you have, but also the way you played the first episode. I mean, to go from being that guarded when we first meet her to being that kind of open and, you know, having no expectations and thinking everything is going to be great. It's a really demanding role, isn't it?
I mean, those were all, you know, all those scenes were taken from real life. And the article, you know, that the show was based on, Jesse Barron had spent so much time with Lynn, and our writer spoke extensively with him. And, you know, we didn't want to give it away. She didn't know at that time. She was just cooking dinner. You know, it was like any other day. And she had to take care of her other two kids. And she was a single mom. And, you know, her son was going off to do something fun. And she was hoping he was going to have a good night. And she was surprised he wasn't going to stay. And that was it. You know, I was just trying to play the realness of the moment.
You know, when we meet her, she's obviously just almost like retreating into her shell. That stuff on the beach where the sun is out, which by this one of the few times you even get to see sun in the show. And she's just relaxed. I mean, I just wonder for you how you chart something like that in terms of the way you can expend your energy.
We had a lot of help with tracking everything with our showrunners, and our creator, Liz Hanna, was on set every day, even though she was like 6 months pregnant or something. We, you know, read through every scene, Colton and I together, and we're just trying to find moments of levity throughout. And it was really important for us to lean into those moments, you know, to show the joy in these people's lives. That was just something we all really wanted to make sure we captured right, and not too like hokey, you know, and just have this like, you know, kind of real moments between mother and son. And, you know, I had a son during the pandemic. My son, he's now almost two. I was working away from him for the first time. So a lot, I mean, not only was I making the show about a mother who had lost her son, but I was away from my son for the first time, thinking about my career and going forward and what that was going to mean, you know, for my livelihood and being away from him. And so it was a very emotional experience.
It's so interesting because you were sort of talking about sort of being in the weeds for a little bit. And I've always thought of you as being an actor who really responds. There's an honesty in you that responds to material. And these last couple of things we were talking about, or even that last season of A Russian Doll, where you really have something to play. And you use the word grounded because I think you really have an affinity for people whose feet are on the ground and who we sort of look to as being like some exemplar of common sense. I mean, even in American Psycho.
I was saying to someone that I'm often cast as like the moral compass for some reason.
What's your affinity with that kind of character? Because it really happens a lot in these things we're talking about.
I don't know. I mean, I would like to say it was intentional, but I think it's just some sort of coincidence. All of my career, I've been more attracted to filmmakers and creators than the actual parts that I was being offered. I don't want to, like, you know, call anyone out, but, you know, certain films, I wasn't so excited to play the secretary, but I was excited about the overall project and the people that were involved. And I was like, this part might not further my career, but I want to be a part of this ensemble, which is why I've mostly done ensemble work as an actor.
You have such a great laugh. I wish you played more comedy, because the comic moments we get to see from you are really a lot of fun. But I just was wondering, part of it is just you're able to find a way to harness your experience into some of these roles.
My first professional acting experience was actually when I was like 8 years old. I did a commercial for a Voltron toy. You know, I saw Annie on Broadway. My mother, we lived in suburban Connecticut. And my mom used to bring me in for shows. And I saw these girls singing and dancing on stage. And I was like, I want to do what those girls are doing. My favorite show was Little House. And I was seeing these girls like solving problems, going on adventures and doing these wild things. And I was like, I want to do what those girls are doing. Not only like what they're actually doing in the show, but I also want to be acting like they are. Like, I knew the difference. Yeah, but I was stuck in this town where I was, I would say, very unhappy, especially as a teen. I was escaping into New York, you know, on the weekends and sometimes even after school, sometimes skipping school, found a whole other world and existence here in the city. You know, I was 18, I was cast in the movie Kids and kind of was off and was running. And then my father passed away soon after that, and I had to support my family. So work became not only like something that I wanted to, that was important to me as an artist. I had like certain goals and things I wanted to achieve, but I also had to make a living.
As an artist, as a person, you have a really good ear and eye for what you want to surround yourself with. And you've gravitated towards that and been able to find ways to make those kinds of situations happen.
Yeah. I mean, I like to say it's luck, but I think like Luca's like, you represent to me something about the movies that isn't really there anymore. And that's why I want to work with you. He's like, you stand for something. And I don't know if people are just projecting all this onto me or if like overall what I've tried to accomplish and kind of achieve to a certain extent. But it's very flattering when someone like that says that to me. Yeah, I just, you know, I've always like, to me, like film work is the most important thing in my life. And I've tried to keep it pretty precious.
It's the treatment. My guest who's revealed herself as a closet fan of Little House, but I'm sure only wears gingham. Ironically, it's Chloe Sevigny. Her newest project is, of course, The Girl from Plainville. I mean, these last three projects for me really just kind of landed in ways I think were really interesting, because at some point they have some light moments in the oddest situations. I mean, especially, you know, the contrasting stuff in Russian Doll, which is, I think, some of the best work you've ever done. I mean, you get to play somebody who's in effect possessed at certain points, and but also trying to sort of hold on to what's left of her dignity.
I have to tell you, I was like very lazy going into Russian Doll. And one should not admit that, talking about wanting to get future jobs. But Natasha Lyonne is like my best friend of 20 something years in real life. When she told me about the premise for season 2, I was like, I got this. You know, I know this person. Like, I watched the first season a couple times and we got on set and all of a sudden I had to kind of do her. And I found it extremely challenging. And we had to like, we did a lot of rehearsing and there were very concise moments where I was trying to impersonate her. But like, I was watching her on the monitor and then they would say, okay, now you go on and do exactly what she just did. And in the body that I was in with the belly and the hair and stuff, it was very challenging. I just like, I was so in awe of her and everything she was doing. And yeah, I just love her so much, but it was surprising to say the least how scary it was. When I got to play Nora, I was like, okay, this is my comfort zone. I can do this. Like, I know how to play Nora. I know the ins and outs of Natasha's real relationship with her mother and, you know, what she was trying to say with the story and what she was trying to capture and give to the audience. And I was on board with that and I could do that. But when I had to be Natasha, whoo, terrifying.
But that's what we've been talking about here, I think, for this entire conversation is that that sense of being grounded. You knew who she was. You knew where her feet were on the ground. And the demands of that, but also not only the demands of that, basically imitating Natasha, but being itself written by her and being directed by her. I mean, what was all of that like for you?
She was very much in line with a lot of directors I've worked with in the past.
Really?
Well, there was a great demand on her schedule-wise. It was just stressful for her. She was also like never happier. And this was like this opportunity that she'd been, you know, working towards for years because we were postponed because of the pandemic. And she had rehearsed every character with an acting coach and like just knew every frame of everything she wanted to capture. And so there was a certain amount of precision that she was executing, which was exhaustive, but also like felt very safe. It was just very explored. You know, she's very verbal and heady, and the show was so ambitious that she had to be prepared. It was terrifying and really felt very safe at the same time.
Again, like I was saying, your characters are often asking a question that we're asking as audiences, what's going on here? And that Natasha and Luca were able to see those qualities and get you to use them in ways that I think maybe others had not. That's why, for me, these three projects kind of stack up in a way that feel career-defining.
Yeah, to me, I mean, the last scene on the train between Natasha and I and Russian Doll, when I say, you know, if you could do it all over again, would you still choose me, is like what the entire season is about. And that she gave me that line, like, and this life that we've lived together and the trust she has in me is fairly meaningful.
Well, I wonder now, I mean, if these things feel like this to you too, these three projects kind of lining up the way they do. Because again, it feels like you were talking about finding stuff that really meant something to you. And these three mm-hmm. pieces of material seem to challenge you in ways that you hadn't been in a very long time.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say a very long time. I'd done the series Bloodline, which I really loved my character, who was also like the moral compass, Chelsea. And people really were drawn to that character. But these last three, they all just felt like, right, like this is the kind of work that I just want to continue doing, and personal, emotional, challenging, yeah, all the things you want great art to be.
We're out of time. My guest, who doesn't nearly laugh as much as she should on screen as Chloe Sevigny, whose newest project is The Girl from Plainville on Hulu. I can't thank you enough for doing this, Chloe. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Chloe Sevigny, who stars in The Girl from Plainville, among other things. The treat, it's writer Danielle Smith on A Heavenly Body Enforcing Non-Moving Violations. Stay with us. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treat. This week, Danielle Smith, author of the book Shine Bright, A Very Personal History of Black Women in Pop, on a certain midnight constellation that keeps her dance flow at the legal speed limit.
My name is Danielle Smith, and this is The Treat.
Excuse me, madam. You're standing still in a no parking zone. If you don't get a move on that body, I'll be forced to give you a ticket. So get with it!
I want to talk about a particular album. It's from 1983, and it's called No Parking on the Dance Floor from Midnight Star. I love this record. I love this album. I don't understand why Midnight Star is not more celebrated, more remembered. Why I don't hear it more often, frankly, even on oldie stations. Songs like No Parking on the Dance Floor. I mean, moving violations are easy to fix. Just tell the DJ to slip it in the mix. It's like, what? It's a whole concept song of like, no parking on the dance floor. I'll give you a ticket if you're standing too still and not dancing out there. Like, move out of the way. Don't go too. It's like a whole thing of like being a driver, but you're a dancer. But it's so fun and the beat is relentless also. And there's a whistle like a traffic cop, and then there's somebody going beep 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 beep. This was a huge record in 1983. This is me at 18, finally able to be outside, being at the 18 and over clubs, dancing to No Parking on the dance floor. And then all through my like junior high school years and high school years, the song that was played at the end of the school dances, because we did have those back then, was always Heat Waves, Always and Forever. And everyone would wait, and then you would be able to dance with the person that you liked. But right around the time of this album, which was also called No Parking on the Dance Floor, it switched over a bit to either A House Is Not a Home from Luther Vandross or Play Another Slow Jam from Midnight Star. So the whole album really is a treat in my life. Play Another Slow Jam is so sweet without being like sticky, you know, it just, it's what you want. I love when it calls to mind like the atmosphere of a situation. It just contributes to the storytelling of the song. The person isn't really asking their person to play another slow jam. You're basically speaking to the DJ. And I love the fact that that's the energy that you get. It's like you're ostensibly maybe hugged up with your person in a good, lovely slow dance. And either in your mind or out loud, you're really just saying like, play another slow jam. You know, just play another one, because I want to be with this person for just one more song at least. You can dance to Electricity and No Parking on the Dance Floor, and then you can just have all the great nostalgic moments, even right now listening to Play Another Slow Jam. And yeah, they just lit up my whole heyday. They lit up my whole heyday.
You heard Danielle Smith, whose newest book is Shine Bright, a very personal history of Black women in pop. The show is produced and edited by Rebecca Mooney and mixed by Katie Gilchrist. Thanks this week to Laura Kandarajan. Coming up, it's Ann Litt with music. Maybe if we're lucky, a little more of Kentucky's funkiest. And yes, that was a request. To better days, everyone. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. What you say is true. I feel the same way too. See, I waited all night long just to dance with you.